Tea Party, there was no leader. It was almost amorphous, but it was the base that had been writ large, that had been created and radicalized by this combination of post-Newt Gingrich politics and conservative media.
Hello, I'm Jeff Cabaservice from the Niskanen Center. Welcome to the Vital Center podcast, where we try to sort through the problems of the muddled, moderate majority of Americans, drawing upon history, biography, and current events. And I'm thrilled to be joined today by Jackie Calmes, who's one of America's greatest political reporters. She covered Congress and the White House for 18 years with the Wall Street Journal, starting in 1990, and ultimately becoming the paper's chief political correspondent. She was then a White House correspondent for the New York Times during the Obama administration, as well as a national politics reporter and chief economic correspondent. Since then, she has been the White House editor and a correspondent with the Los Angeles Times' Washington Bureau. And she is the author of the terrific new book, Dissent, The Radicalization of the Republican Party and Its Capture of the Court. Welcome, Jackie.
Good to be with you, Jeff.
Good to have you here. Jackie, as you know, I am a big fan of the reportage in Dissent, which focuses on Brett Kavanaugh's personal history, his rise through conservative activist circles, and his tumultuous Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Mm-hmm. But I'm equally a fan of your work in that book as a historian and your ability to place the Kavanaugh hearings, as well as the Trump presidency, in the context of changes in the Republican Party. And I want to read from the opening lines of Dissent, because I was so struck by this. You wrote, "As my 40th anniversary in journalism approached, Donald Trump had just been elected president. While his victory was a surprise, including to himself, he was no political aberration. Trump's rise in the Republican Party was the logical result of the party's ever-rightward, populist, and anti-government evolution, a shift that coincided with my career in political journalism and was its single biggest story." And in many ways, that is the history that I've been following as well in my own research and writing, and I really love how you told this tale. But before we get into some of the specifics of your pursuit of that story, can you tell me something about your own background and how you came to be interested in political reporting as a career?
Wow, that's a big question. Well, from my earliest childhood, I gravitated to reading books of history and biographies. As a child, I remember there was this series of biographies in the public library that were biographies written for children about famous characters, mostly men, of course, but there were a few on women, and I read them all. And so when people talk about Nancy Drew and those sorts of books, I don't know what they're talking about because I wasn't reading fiction, I was just reading history. So then as I got older, and, you know, I knew I liked to write. I loved history. It was a matter of figuring out how do I make a living at that? And the only way I really could figure that out was journalism. And the other advantage journalism has is you can do you can get a job with a bachelor's degree. I wouldn't have had to come up with the money for advanced degrees, although I then did get a master's degree in journalism at Northwestern. But that's another separate story I won't bore you with. But so I also got into journalism because I wanted to see the country. When I grew up, people think I was gravitated towards journalism because I sort of came of age during the Watergate period, you know, Bernstein and Woodward, and I wanted to be the female version. But I had actually, my interest predated that. Like I say, it went back into elementary school. So when I was at Northwestern, a recruiter came to the school for a chain of Texas papers, and he had an opening at their one of their 14 papers was Abilene, Texas, in West Texas. And so I thought, well, I've never been out of the Ohio, Michigan, Illinois area, so that's a part of the country I'd like to see. So I took the job. I didn't particularly like living in Abilene, but within the year, I was transferred and promoted to cover state government in Austin for the papers chain. So within the year of getting out of college, I was covering politics and government. And I've never stopped. And I've loved it from the start. And I've seen the country, I've seen the world with presidents. And there's really no better way to see the world than traveling with a U.S. president. You get into rooms you would never get into as a tourist and see people like a drunk Boris Yeltsin in Moscow one time. So it's been great all around. And I never would have guessed how much the journalism industry would change and how much politics would change in that 40 years. So it's been quite a ride.
You grew up in the Toledo, Ohio area, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Did you grow up reading the Toledo Blade?
Yes. And I'm old enough that my father also subscribed to the Toledo Times, which for a while was what we call the morning paper, and the Toledo Blade was the afternoon paper. So that also made me interested in journalism. How in the world do you know about the Toledo Blade?
Well, I've actually been thinking about this because the Niskanen Center website just published a paper that I edited by Robert Saldine and Cal Moonis and Richard Burke on the decline of local newspapers. Uh-huh. And that has a real connection to the decline of local community and perhaps to the decline of local democracy as well. Mm-hmm. And on the television side, there actually was an interesting set of posts in I think it's the Knight Cronkite News Lab on the talent shortage in local TV newsrooms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really seems to me that there actually is great value in having started your reporting career in a place like Abilene, Texas, after having read a strong quality local newspaper like the Toledo Blade.
Right. Right. And, you know, it's interesting because when I was at Northwestern, a lot of my sort of, shall we say, more privileged classmates were holding out for job offers from the likes of the networks or, you know, the national newspapers. And probably, I know it was because I didn't have the luxury. I needed to immediately get a job so I could pay all of my school debt. I took the job as I did at a small paper. And I have, ever since that time, I have considered that I was the smarter. Not only did my friends not get those jobs they were holding out for, but they didn't get the sort of experience I did that, you know, you get to do everything when you're at a small local paper, and you get to, I think it's important, especially if you're going to go on to cover politics, that you see things from that local level. And I mean, it was just a stroke of luck that I was seeing Texas when I did at that point where the governor, it was just the eve of the Reagan Revolution, and the South, including Texas, was about to switch from one party Democratic to eventually one party Republican. And so it's, but local, I'm looking forward to this paper you described because I really do think the decline of local journalism, and it's getting worse by the day, is one of the reasons we find ourselves in the position we do of our democracy being under threat. I have a friend, for instance, who had been in journalism with me years ago, but then he got a law degree, ultimately became chief of staff to a governor of Oregon. And he told me not so long ago that there's next to no local coverage in the state capitol or local papers in the state capitol press corps in Salem, Oregon. And he said the state legislators can get away with murder. And, you know, that's the thing. I mean, the accountability, you're missing a whole level of accountability, nonpartisan accountability that voters need to make informed decisions.
I totally agree. As you mentioned, 1978 was a momentous midterm election during the Jimmy Carter presidency in the South, because that really marked some of the first breakthroughs of the Republican Party into what had been the Solid South. And Texans elected Bill Clements, who was the first Republican governor since Reconstruction. And even some of the Democrats who got elected that year, like Phil Graham, were very conservative boll weevil Democrats.
Charlie Stenholm in Abilene.
Right, who went on to become proto-Republicans. What I find interesting is you also reported that year on one of the Republicans who lost, which was George W. Bush, who was running in Texas's 19th district, which I guess is somewhat near Abilene.
Yeah, to the west, Midland, Odessa.
There's a great story. I still remember that he lost to Democrat Kent Hance, who was kind of a folksy guy.
Yes.
And George W. Bush had, you know, been a Yale graduate and business school graduate not that long beforehand, and he shot a campaign ad that showed him jogging, presenting a strong physical appearance. But, you know, joggers were pretty rare in that part of Texas. And Hans's comment was, the only time folks around here go running is when someone's chasing them.
Yeah. I tell you, Hans had a great sense of humor. And that was one of the things that helped get him elected. He had been a state senator in Texas. And And yes, it was, you know, but again, George W. Bush did better in that election in 1978 than he was expected to. But, you know, Democrats had a real advantage back then. And the fact that Bush did as well as he did was a sign of the wave to come for Republicans.
And then, of course, Texas went for Ronald Reagan in 1980, although mm-hmm. it had gone for Carter in 76. And the Senate also turned Republican for the first time since the Eisenhower presidency. So
oh, yeah.
you really were sort of witnessing the beginning of the conservative revolution at that time.
Absolutely.
And then you moved to Washington in 1984 to work for Congressional Quarterly. And for our friends who don't live inside the Beltway, what is CQ?
Well, CQ is not... back then, it's different from what exists today. It's been sort of folded into other publications now. But back then, it was a weekly magazine, even though it was called Congressional Quarterly. And then they took to calling it CQ Weekly. But it was, you know, someone who, when I heard I was coming to Washington, said that if I really wanted to learn about Congress, I should go to Congressional Quarterly. And it was sort of an adjustment because I like newspapering and daily deadlines and just, you know, the pace of a newsroom. And CQ was a little bit more, was slower and more detail oriented, but boy, did I get to know about Congress down to the technical and procedural parliamentary level. And so I was there for the better part of 5 years. It was another advantage I had over daily newspapers is that not having a daily deadline, I could, like, at the end of a day, walk around the halls of the congressional offices and just pop in and talk to staffers, even talk to members sometimes. I, after hours, have red wine with Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico, the Republican whose family were Italian immigrants, and he loved to get out the red wine. And you could really, you know, so it was a real learning experience, not just in what I was writing, but in what I was able to do in taking the time to build sourcing and learn things that reporters don't really have today in our 24/7 internet age.
And I know it's a big and ultimately unanswerable question, but how was Washington, how was Congress, how was politics different at that time from what it is now?
Well, it was all new to me at the time, pretty much, but it was interesting that it seemed very partisan. I mean, I remember writing things and we'd talk and members would kvetch about just how partisan things were. And yet, you had, in each party, you had a range of members from left to right on the spectrum. You had liberal Republicans and you had very conservative Democrats. And over time, they all left. Either the liberal Republicans got, their party got rid of them in Republican primaries when more conservative people ran against them. And a lot of the most conservative Democrats either switched parties to the Republican Party or lost in their party primaries. And so you had this homogenization of both parties over time. But, you know, in the Reagan era, it still seemed very partisan. And yet now we look back and it seems like the good old days compared to what we have now with I don't even consider it partisanship. It's polarization now. It's almost a parliamentary government where you have each party sort of votes in lockstep for the most part. Democrats, as we see, are less guilty of that than Republicans are. But it was really exciting. Because you had diversity within each party to some extent, it made the votes on legislation hard to predict and more sort of exciting to watch. And so what I saw, you know, started to change big time with the Newt Gingrich era in the 90s. In the House. I say in the 90s, it had actually started by the mid to late 80s when I was there. You could see the ferment among House Republicans who had been a minority since the early 50s and were restless about it and considered that the leadership of the party was too complacent, too cooperative with the Democrats, and had a minority mindset. And so the Gingrich era, the Republicans in the House started to radicalize when they decided that the way to shake things up was to be far more militant. Forget legislative compromises. Let's just battle it out and then take it to the voters.
And how much of that change do you ascribe to Gingrich?
I ascribe a lot of it to Gingrich, but he, you know, started out as a, what you and I know or used to call Rockefeller Republicans, the more liberal to moderate variety of Republicans that reflected former New York governor and then Vice President Nelson Rockefeller. And so he was an opportunist, Newt Gingrich was, who sort of, you know, saw that this was taking hold in the Republican Party, because it was taking hold already because of the license that Ronald Reagan had given to the conservatives in the party. Ronald Reagan represented, you know better than me, a victory for the conservative wing of the party in what had been a decades long battle within the party between moderates and the moderate establishment and the conservative activists and the conservative wing. And this wing under Reagan became empowered. And through the 80s, they became restive and wanted to exert their power. And Reagan likewise gave rise to things like, you know, very conservative think tanks on the right that also provided ideas, new ideas, and for Republicans. And there was also groups that empowered that were brought a more militant style to the party. And Gingrich harnessed all of that by the mid to late 80s. I mean, he had started what was called the Conservative Opportunity Society. And as I write in my book, some of the members who were allied with him on that came to saying that Newt Gingrich was more opportunist than conservative. But nonetheless, he, by the late 80s, had made his way into House Republican leadership, and the establishment chafed at his style. He didn't come to Congress to pass legislation. And that became more and more true of Republicans in general that were elected with his help. He had what was called GOPAC, the Political Action Committee, which provided not just money for other conservative candidates, but also tapes for them how to talk. In fact, and his slogan was "Be Nasty," which pretty much encapsulated his style. So he, I think, harnessed what was already percolating within the Republican Party and then took it to a whole new level and personalized it. And people, you know, that weren't around at the time don't realize just he was sort of the pre-Trump. He was everywhere. He was on the cover. You remember he was Time Magazine's Man of the Year, and he was a big, big deal. And the pre-Trump.
Yeah. Which segments of the Republican Party or the conservative movement seemed to care most about the courts, in your estimation?
You know, I did. The courts was more in the background in my experience up to then. I mean, I knew about the Federalist Society, which was one, like when I say that the Reagan's victory and his presidency empowered and gave license to some of these groups. It was, you know, the Federalist Society was formed on Yale's campus, Yale and University of Chicago law professors were its mentors, not least Antonin Scalia and Robert Bork, and formed in 1982, like I say, and it just surprised itself by its success in going from organization of conservative students on campuses to, when they graduated, becoming lawyer groups in the cities where they found jobs. And next thing you know, there's a de facto job ladder from, you know, Federalist Society members who could then get into administration jobs in the Reagan and Bush administrations and then get on federal judgeships and all the way on up until we have now today. All six of our conservative or Republican appointees on the Supreme Court have been or are Federalist Society members. I don't remember, you know, there were fights over judicial nominees in the Senate from the time I came, but they, again, were not as pitched as they would become, in part because you had Republican senators, for instance, who would vote against a Reagan appointee or a George Bush appointee as being too extreme, too far right. And it was really, you know, obviously Robert Bork's nomination to the Supreme Court in 1987 was the first big fight that I covered and that a lot of people will remember. And to this day, obviously, conservatives go back to, in the book, I refer to Robert Bork's nomination fight and then Clarence Thomas's in 1991 as the bloody shirts that conservatives to this day like to wave whenever there's a Supreme Court nomination, as if to suggest that Democrats are more liable than Republicans for making battles against judicial nominees and doing so in a way that amounts to what the other side would call character assassination. And so that really was something that evolved too, on a parallel track with the increased radicalization of the Republican Party itself.
So skipping ahead a bit, you and I first crossed paths, I think, in early 2015, when you were a fellow at the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. How did that fellowship come about?
It fell in my lap, luckily. I had all, you know, at the time I was a New York Times White House reporter. All throughout my career, I'd been too busy to, mostly with my job, but also raising two kids, to think about taking things or applying for seminars or fellowships. And I got a call one day from the head of the program at the Shorenstein Center asking if I would like to be a fellow. And I said, sure. I checked with my bureau chief at the New York Times. She was very supportive. But that meant, since I hadn't applied, I also didn't have a research topic to propose working on during the semester. And I talked to a couple of my colleagues, and I pretty quickly came to one that had been gnawing at me for a long time, which was, you know, to summarize my area of study or what I researched at point, was the expansion of conservative media in the internet age and its corrosive impact on the Republican Party. And so in my earliest research, in order to sort of see how the Republican Party had come to where it was, one of the first, if not the very first book I read was yours, Rule and Ruin. I always have to look at it's Rule or Ruin or Ruin. It's Rule and Ruin, of course. The Downfall of Moderation and Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. And then I also in addition to you, also central to my thinking or getting me started, was Nicole Hemmer, a political scientist who was working on her doctorate, and she was studying and continues to study the impact of conservative media. And I was so interested in this because I had this, it wasn't actually, I didn't consider it a particularly novel idea, to say the least, but having watched the Gingrich era and then on through George W. Bush's presidency and the Tea Party, you know, and in that time from 1996 on, I had seen the growth of Fox News, but even more influential, it seemed, were these websites that were forming that were on the far right. And like Breitbart.com. And I could see, not only could I see the impact it was having on among Republicans in Congress, but I was fielding complaints and had been for several years from Republican leadership staffers or members about just what a corrosive impact it was having on their members, that they had no control over their members anymore because their members were just going on Fox or going to Breitbart, or there was just this back and forth that empowered the members, that they had this channel to this media that was, you know, it was sort of a chicken and the egg. It's like, which one was calling the shots? Were the conservative media just trying to get clicks and viewers by putting out really right-wing stuff there, extreme stuff? Or were they reflecting what the grassroots and wanted? And in any case, there was this cross-pollination that was just really coming to impact what was happening on the Hill and the increasing polarization. And so it was a really good opportunity for me to stop and look into that.
And your paper called They Don't Give a Damn About Governing, Conservative Media's Influence on the Republican Party. did anticipate a lot of the themes of Nikki Hemmer's book, Messengers on the Right. Mm-hmm. And I particularly like the quote you had from Tom Latham, who I guess had just retired as a Republican member of the House, which gave your paper that quote. He was talking about conservative media and how they really just ignore the need for deliberation and compromise that the founders built into the legislative process. Right. And he told you, they will not take 80%. It's got to be 100% or you're not pure. They don't give a damn about governing.
Yeah. The interesting thing about Tom Latham, the at that point retiring congressman from Iowa, is that he had been a member of the Gingrich Revolutionary Republican class of 1994, elected in 1994. And he began, at the time he arrived in Congress in January 95, he was among the most conservative members. And by the time he left, he was completely disillusioned and worried for his party. And it was worse than what you say about they, you know, discourage or look down on compromise, which, as you and I would agree, is essential. As they say, it's the art of politics. They not only looked down, they penalized it. You had seen by 2015 a number of examples where prominent and undeniably conservative Republicans were challenged and defeated in Republican primary elections or conventions because they had committed the mortal sin of compromising with a Democrat. I mean, the best example that pops to mind and which really put a chill in many Republicans in Congress was in 2010, the Tea Party year, when Robert Bennett, a conservative from Utah senator, was defeated for renomination in a Utah convention of the Utah Republican Party, chiefly because he had specifically come up with a compromise healthcare plan with Democrat Ron Wyden of Oregon. And the idea that this respected conservative could be not conservative enough simply because he had compromised with a Democrat was just, you know, well, so memorable. I'm here talking about it today, but it really did scare other Republicans into not compromising anymore. You could just see it, the impact of that. So the extent to which just simple compromise became a four-letter word was so destructive.
Your paper didn't quite predict the triumph of Donald Trump, but no. You did notice that Trump was one of the relatively few Republican presidential candidates in 2015 who would repeatedly appear on like second or third tier radio shows like the Steve Dace show out of Iowa, and would get a very favorable response from his audience.
Yeah. And because he really was speaking to that audience, you know, to this people just liked that he was saying what they thought, what they and saying it in a way that they, especially, and we're talking, most of these audiences were predominantly white male, and he had great appeal to them. Now, Steve Dace himself, the conservative who's still a conservative broadcaster in Iowa and who takes his sort of influence from the fact that he does work in the state that is the first to vote in presidential nominating contests, he came not to like Trump himself, and especially was turned off when that in 2015 later after my after I'd already written my paper, that when Trump famously said that he didn't like Senator John McCain because he didn't like people in the military who got captured. And right. Dace, that turned him off. But Dace has since become he seems pretty Trumpy to me as I follow him on Twitter. So he just is sort of indicative of the rest of the Republican Party, which in fact has become the Trump Party.
You know, there are 1,000 reasons we could come up with for Trump's success, both in the Republican presidential primaries in 2016 and then in the general election. But what in hindsight seemed to you to be some of the big reasons?
For the rise of Trump? I think Trump was sort of the ultimate opportunist. He saw that the Republican Party base was one that, I mean, it played to the issues that he had actually, in fairness, been talking about since the late 80s, you know, sort of a xenophobic message against immigrants. He went back and forth on sort of like the Republican Party was doing at that point on military. He didn't like military adventurism, and yet he wasn't quite isolationist. To this day, he insists he wasn't once in favor of the Iraq invasion when actually he was. This base was there, and he, having been, 14 seasons on The Apprentice, he knew how to play the media, use the media, and to a mass audience, sort of, I don't want to say lowest common denominator, but it wasn't exactly highbrow television of The Apprentice. And so he was very adept at the media, and like I say, he spoke their language. He has been shameless from the time he was in the New York tabloids in the 80s, and he shocked everyone. He was in a field in 2015, 2016 for that 2016 nomination fight that included some of the stars of the Republican Party, and, led perhaps by Jeb Bush and Senator Marco Rubio, and Ted Cruz was in the mix, of course, and Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin. I mean, nobody in the Republican Party I talked to was predicting that Trump would emerge as a winner, and people didn't even take him seriously, including in journalism. People put their B-team reporters on Trump. And within a short time, he had come to the front of the polls, as you remember. And then once the voting started, it was virtually over. And by March of 2016, he was the nominee apparent. He took this base that had already been radicalized by, first Newt and then through the Tea Party era. And he spoke their language, and he was shameless. And unlike the members, the leadership of the party, which had been throwing red meat to the base for years, but knowing that they wouldn't do anything about it once they were elected, because they either couldn't, like as in balancing the budget, or knew it would be terrible politics for general elections, like defunding Planned Parenthood or repealing Obamacare. The base had become so disillusioned by all of these broken promises and stoked by conservative media, which was constantly complaining about the Republican establishment at that point, that Trump was able to waltz in as the most anti-establishment candidate of them all and win the nomination.
I agree. But to return to those first sentences of your book, you said that Trump was no political aberration. His rise was the logical result of the party's rightward trajectory. In 2015, 2016, he was far from the most orthodox conservative candidate. In fact, he might have been the most unorthodox conservative.
Right.
So is there a contradiction there?
I don't think so, in part because of the extent to which by the time he came along, the base was sort of like the tail was wagging the dog. The base was sort of effectively calling the shots. The leadership of the party was reacting to the base. And conservatism, as we think of it, was, policy ideas no longer seem to be all that important if you consider, or at least the old ideas that united the party weren't. You had, trade, free trade and immigrant, sort of a liberal, somewhat, I say liberal, I don't mean open borders, but immigration was considered a good thing. And balanced budgets, low spending. And Trump was opposed to all of that, but so was the base. I mean, in the Tea Party, for instance, you had people protesting Congress saying, keep your hands off my Medicare. They're, with the base had rejected the Paul Ryan kind of ideas of entitlement reform. So when I say Trump was the logical extension, I'm thinking in terms of the leadership of the party had essentially, and not just post Gingrich had created this more militant base that eschewed compromise, but also in the conservative media had done so. I mean, I think we all tend to underestimate the impact of conservative media in this. I can't think of the word. The relationship is, it's sort of like I say, chicken and egg between the audience and the who was influencing whom, you know, the audience or the broadcasters. But in any case, there was this mutual radicalization that was, that's what Trump was the logical extension of, the fact that the party had become, I talk about four revolutions, of which Trump was the fourth, Reagan, and then Gingrich, and then that third revolution, and the one that was the predicate for Trump, was a sort of, what I say, bottom up. It was in these other, and any previous sort of political movement usually has a leader that's associated with it. In this one, the Tea Party, there was no leader. It was almost amorphous, but it was the base that had been writ large, that had been created and radicalized by this combination of post-Newt Gingrich politics and conservative media. And so that was what Trump was an extension of. He took that headless movement and he harnessed it and he became the leader of it.
In hindsight, one of Trump's most durable legacies, I am sure, will be seen to have been his appointment of three conservative Supreme Court justices, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett.
Yes.
And the nomination process for each was extremely controversial, in Gorsuch's case because then-Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell failed to allow a vote to confirm President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, allegedly because the vacancy occurred during the 2016 election year. In Barrett's case, the nomination was controversial because the Senate, controlled by Republicans, confirmed her days before the 2020 election.
Yep.
And then the controversies surrounding Kavanaugh, of course, were in a different register altogether.
Right.
But the appointment of those three judges, as you describe it, brings to fruition this 40-year conservative movement plan to get a conservative majority on the court. And even though that goal was tangential at best to Trump's populist vision to the extent that he had one.
Yeah.
So how did you come to the idea of writing a book about Brett Kavanaugh as a sort of representative figure for the Republican Party's rightward transformation?
Well, it was sort of, again, it was one of these things that sort of fell in my lap, which is why I guess I was smart to never make five-year plans. But I had been talking to an agent and an editor at one of the publishing houses about, since early 2017, after Trump's election, and I had left the New York Times and wanted to do more in-depth journalism, including writing a book. And so I was talking to this agent and this editor about trying to come up with a book concept that would allow me to tell the story of the 40 years that I had witnessed, or was coming up on 40 years, of the evolution of the Republican Party. And at that point, I was calling it the evolution or the transformation. I thought radicalization was a bridge too far, but I quickly dispensed with that thinking, and radicalization seemed just right. But any case, because of the press of, I then got a job as a White House editor, I was just too busy to think about the book. And then they came to me in 2018, when just as Brett Kavanaugh was about to be confirmed, and they wanted a book on the controversial confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, about him. And I didn't particularly want to write a book that was just about him. So I countered by suggesting, you know, I knew a little bit about him. And I thought he was sort of like the perfect, what some people call Petri dish Republican, that he sort of represented the perfect specimen of what it takes to succeed in the Republican Party these days, which is a blend of politics as well as conservative policies record. But he just was, you know, again, also what a couple senators called him was a Forrest Gump or Zelig-like figure, where he just was uncannily at the scene of some of the biggest moments in the Republican Party's evolution. And so I thought, so what we came to is I would write this book about Kavanaugh and his story from his birth within the beltway of Washington, D.C. to a Republican lobbyist father and a mother who had changed parties from Democrat to Republican in this same era, as so many people did. In any case, juxtapose his story with what was happening more broadly in the Republican Party, both in the political arena and in this evolution of the Federalist Society and other conservative organs to create this sort of de facto system of identifying and vetting true what they would be considered true conservatives for the judiciary from all district, appeals court, Supreme Court, which has been successful beyond any of the founders' dreams. And so that's what I did. And I think it worked pretty well. I mean, just to summarize, I mean, Kavanaugh, when I say that he was this zealot-like figure, he was, like I say, born within the Beltway. He went to Yale, which was the founding camp, and Yale Law School, and joined the Federalist Society just a couple years after it had been formed. He quickly saw that it was a good point of reference to have on your resume if you wanted to move up in the Republican circles. He worked for Ken Starr, who was the Solicitor General under George W. H.W. Bush, right? Did I get that right?
Yes.
Or was it end of Reagan? I think George H.W. Bush. And so in any case, and then again, when he clerked for some of the most conservative judges on the federal bench, and then ultimately Anthony Kennedy wasn't one of the most conservative, but he was a Republican appointee on the Supreme Court. So from there, Kavanaugh went to Ken Starr and for 4 years worked for Ken Starr on the investigation of Bill and Hillary Clinton, which I think was really the era in which he, like so many other people, became much more, he became more partisan and the country became more divided along political lines. And then, you know, he was, did some private practice in which he worked what he considered a pro bono on some politically charged cases that were popular on the conservative in the conservative community. And then from Bush v. Gore, which he, like a lot of Republican lawyers, had a role, secured a job in the West Wing of George Bush's White House, George W. Bush's White House, and from and immediately was seen as again, he'd been marked for the federal bench because he was a proven, not just a proven conservative, but a loyal Republican. So, you know, the rest is history. He went from the other thing, when he was nominated for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, he became representative of what had become by that point, you asked earlier about judicial fights, by the George W. Bush era, the judicial confirmations there were more battles than not in a lot of these appeals court nominations. His took 3 years. And then, you know, George W. Bush predicted that some Republican president would make Brett Kavanaugh a Supreme Court justice. And indeed, Trump did.
Although, interestingly, you also point out that Kavanaugh's associations with the Bushes counted against him in the Trump era, yeah, at least among some of Trump's most populist advisors.
Yes. So Trump had come out with these three lists of to reassure evangelical voters and conservative voters generally that he would indeed name conservatives to the court and to the courts of all levels. But he put out this list twice before he was elected of actual people he would name. No one had done this. And yet Brett Kavanaugh's name, even though Brett Kavanaugh was in, you know, anybody you asked in the conservative legal community would have named Brett Kavanaugh as among their prospective Supreme Court candidates. He didn't make Trump's list until after Trump was already president and a year into his presidency when Trump came out with a third list. And a lot of it was just this, you know, Trump was, as you suggest, wanted nothing to do with anything that smacked of the Bush era. He was as dismissive of George W. Bush and everything he represented as he was of Barack Obama. And so, but I think that one thing that overcame it was in a large part, Trump's White House counsel, Don McGahn, knew Kavanaugh well and really liked the fact that Kavanaugh, like Neil Gorsuch, is somebody who casts a real skeptical eye, opposes much federal regulation of business and the environment and such. And so the administrative state, as they say, and so he was really keen. And I think without Don McGahn, Brett Kavanaugh would not have been a Trump nominee.
But then curiously, what does endear Kavanaugh to Trump supporters is his lashing out at the left during his confirmation hearings.
Yes.
And you provide a very detailed, sensitive, nuanced discussion of those hearings, the accusations brought against Kavanaugh by psychologist Christine Blasey Ford, as well as what really had been underreported stories about sexual incidents in which he'd been involved as an undergraduate at Yale.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, a lot of people will say that Trump should not have gotten to fill the Scalia seat that went to Neil Gorsuch or the Ruth Bader Ginsburg seat that went to Amy Coney Barrett. But I think it's also the one seat Trump was obviously within his rights as president to have filled was the one from Anthony Kennedy's retirement. But, you know, there's a lot of other conservatives who could have filled that seat other than Brett Kavanaugh. And I think, you know, we all know about Christine Blasey Ford, but the one, the case that Republicans being the majority in the Senate right then were able to just railroad was the allegation from Debbie Ramirez, who had been his classmate at Yale and suggested that he had, and she, you know, acknowledged she had been very drunk and that he had exposed himself to her and with his friends essentially forced her to handle his penis. And it was, she never got the hearing that Christine Blasey Ford did. I met Debbie and talked to her at length multiple times. I think she would have been at least as credible a witness as Christine Blasey Ford. And you don't have to take my word. I mean, it was Trump himself who, after Christine Blasey Ford testified publicly, said she was both credible and compelling. Of course, this was before he subsequently and ever since has called her a liar. But, you know, and it was not just, it was disturbing to me the way they were able to just railroad it through. They only allowed for an FBI investigation when they had to, because they would have lost at least two Republican votes if they didn't have this investigation. But the investigation was a sham. It was really no investigation at all, as I go into in my book. And there were so many of Brett Kavanaugh's classmates who wanted to testify as to his, you know, didn't have anything to do with the sexual assault allegations. But the fact that they felt, and these were people who had been friends of his, friendly acquaintances of his, and they said when they saw him on Fox News and then in his testimony before the Senate that he had lied about the extent of his drinking. He had lied when he denied that he had never blacked out from drinking, couldn't remember what he had done. All of that was central to his defense, because if he had blacked out and or couldn't remember what he had done, it would have been more possible to believe that he had sexually assaulted someone when he was terribly drunk and just didn't remember it. So it would undercut his denials. But in addition to that, there was this a third allegation from another Yale woman who, and this has been reported, which never came out. And she, you know, she says she does not remember. I've talked to her friends, and she was so drunk that she didn't remember. But there is an eyewitness, a very credible eyewitness, but he wanted only to talk to the FBI and to the Senate and off the record. So the thinking being that if he told them what he had seen on top of the other allegations, that the senators would go to the White House and tell Trump to nominate someone else. He was never allowed to talk to the FBI. To this day has not contacted him. He was never allowed to talk to the senators privately. And so, you know, and Kavanaugh's confirmation was rushed through. But as I say in the book, and I've written since, you can set aside the sexual assault allegations, if you like, if you think those things can never be determined. There are other, were lies that Brett Kavanaugh told under oath, not just about his college age drinking, but also about things that he had been asked about in his incidents that occurred when he was a White House aide to George W. Bush, and in having to do with a Senate scandal over Democrat stolen emails, over judicial nominees that Brett Kavanaugh worked on, and some policy areas, for instance, having to do with the handling of foreign detainees in the what the Bush administration called the War on Terror. All of these things undercut his credibility even before you get into a he said, she said fight. And it just, to me, the argument is compelling when you take the allegations, which can't be answered, these other, the record that shows that he, that suggests very strongly that he at best misled the senators under oath, at worst lied, and the add to that the what I would consider, and frankly, you know, former, the, now the late Justice John Paul Stevens considered his disqualifying tirade on September 27th, 2018, when he answered, when he testified after Christine Blasey Ford before the Senate Judiciary Committee in such a angry, partisan, confrontational manner that it, completely opposite to anything we would consider as reflecting judicial temperament. I think by all rights, he should have been, his nomination should have been withdrawn and another conservative put in his place.
I was a year behind Kavanaugh in college, mm-hmm. and I do remember him with beer in hand, kind of a look of an aggrieved opossum on his face, which I suppose is neither here nor there. But I guess the question is, do you think the Democrats could have handled this nomination in a way that would have led to some other outcome? Or is this his nomination simply a product of the polarized dynamic that we have now in Congress?
I don't think there's certainly things Democrats could have done better and should have done. I mean, somehow the allegation from the eyewitness, there should have been a way to force that into the Senate, inner the circle in a way that maybe would have kept it from becoming public, but at least senators would have known about it. But frankly, I don't think there's anything Democrats could have done that was going to overcome then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's determination to ram that nomination through. And combined with that, I mean, that was critical to Kavanaugh's success. He would not, it was the continued support of Donald Trump. I mean, we all watched Donald Trump for 4 years. He could just as well have like kicked Kavanaugh to the curb and named somebody else on his list, but he didn't. And perversely, I think part of that is because of the nature of the allegations against Trump. Trump has a well-known record and a long one, and he's added to it since, of coming, you know, not only in his, when allegations are lodged against him, but against any man of a sexual nature, it just gets his juices going. And he came to the defense. This was his kind of fight. And he was going to defend Brett Kavanaugh against this. And Brett Kavanaugh's angry performance before the Senate Judiciary Committee was, like so many other things Republicans did in the Trump era, was for an audience of one. And it pleased Trump, who already had made known that he was not happy with Brett Kavanaugh's appearance on Fox News with his wife earlier, in which he thought Kavanaugh had been too much of a sort of a whimpering puppy, and he wanted him to go on the attack. And Don McGahn coached Kavanaugh to that effect. But I'm not, you know, Kavanaugh was a politically savvy. It's people have suggested to me, forget what I think. Republicans have suggested he didn't need Don McGahn to tell him to come out with all guns blazing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He knew that's what Trump wanted, and Trump embraced it. And Trump nominated him, and Trump made sure he got confirmed. And Mitch McConnell, of course, was equally responsible.
You know, there was an article just a few days ago in the New York Times, which is talking about how Kavanaugh has come to wield enormous power as the justice at the court's ideological center, which, of course, is not to be confused with making him a moderate. He's not moderate. He's come down on the right side on a number of issues. But he has voted, I think, 91% of the time in divided decisions with John Roberts, the Chief Justice. Mm-hmm. And he seems to share some of Roberts' concerns for protecting the institutional authority of the court.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the sort of $64 question here in Washington, but mm-hmm. how do you think Kavanaugh is likely to vote in some contentious issues we can see coming up, particularly abortion?
Well, abortion specifically, I see him. I mean, I ultimately think the court is going to find a way, the conservatives on the court, the six justice supermajority, to greatly undercut, if not effectively do away with abortion rights, much as, you know, Texas has effectively done away with abortion rights, even though they haven't come right out and banned them altogether. You know, they'll find a way to do that in these two cases from Texas and Mississippi, without producing the headline that says court overturns Roe v. Wade. And I very much think Kavanaugh will be in, being on the DC Court of Appeals, that's a court, you know, considered the second most prestigious, that based here in Washington, mainly is known for handling cases having to do with issues of which the federal government is a party. And so you didn't get a lot of abortion cases, but towards the end of his 12-year tenure there, there was one in which he was very much, it was, you know, people say he was auditioning for a Supreme Court nomination by his coming down very strongly in an anti-abortion way in a case that came before that court. So I have no doubt that he will be deciding against abortion, but I also think that partly because of what you suggest about he and the Chief Justice are cognizant of the court's public standing and institutional standing, he will not want to just flat out overturn Roe. But I also think in his case, it reflects his political savvy. This is a guy who was working, you know, from the Ken Starr years on through the Bush first term, very much as someone who was at the center of the biggest political fights of our day. And I think he knows that it would not be good for the Republican Party to have an outright overturning of Roe versus Wade, but he will support anything that goes right up to that point. When the other major case of the term, of course, is going to be on gun rights. And he has signaled throughout his judicial career on the Court of Appeals and in his short time on the Supreme Court, that he is very much for expanding gun rights and for expanding the individual right to bear arms, which was only carved out on the Supreme Court in 2008 in the Heller case. And he, in fact, was quite vocal in terms of one of his judicial writings in a dissent bemoaning the fact that the court had not accepted a gun case in more than a decade since Heller and McDonald, and that he was very eager for the court to take up a case, and now they have one, and I think he will definitely be in favor of expanding gun rights.
It does seem, for a number of reasons, that the Republicans have been much more focused on the courts and appointing conservative justices than the Democrats have been interested with and made a priority of judicial appointments in recent decades. Does that seem like a fair statement?
Oh, absolutely. And it's a cause of no small concern to a lot of Democratic activists. And frankly, I've wondered through the years, I mean, going back to the early 90s when, you know, the famous case that upheld Roe versus Wade, although limited a bit, was Planned Parenthood versus Casey, case out of Pennsylvania in 1993. So those are considered the two big abortion cases, you know, Roe and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. And it was, I have always, you know, long seen that abortion rights, among others, were in danger of the precedents being overruled, and Democratic voters never seem to care as much about the courts. But when you think about it, it makes sense because the post-Warren, the Earl Warren era of the '60s, that so greatly expanded civil rights and the like, criminal rights, and was. You know, there was a complacency on the left and the center left that while the right was really mobilized by cases going back to the '60s having to do with prayer in schools, then Roe versus Wade, and you know, religious rights, and so there was more reason for, and the more you brought evangelicals into the party, the Republican Party, that became even more true. And then the business wing of the Republican Party was, wanted to fight a lot of these environmental regulations and other business regulations. So there was much more incentive on the right, to, and center right even, to have the court be an issue. That started to change with Bush v. Gore when Democrats sat up and thought, you know, holy cow, a 5-4 conservative majority could essentially pick the president. And so you saw the beginnings of efforts to form an analog to the Federalist Society, but it just didn't work. The Democrats just don't have the incentive that the right does to work the courts. So that is beginning to change, has changed some. And you see it in Joe Biden's judicial nominations, the sort of people he's nominating to the court. But it's still it's still an imbalance, great imbalance.
And, you know, one gets a sense, for example, that a Republican administration, if the situation's been reversed, would have strongly encouraged someone like Ruth Bader Ginsburg to retire rather than die in office and give the opposing party a chance to appoint a justice of their liking. It just doesn't seem that the Democrats have been playing politics all that well in recent years.
Right. And they can't. And Stephen Breyer, continues to resist the pressure he's under. And I get that. That said, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean, Barack Obama went to the extent of having, you know, lunch with her and making it clear, you know, I mean, but they both, we don't know how explicit he was, but it's clear that what the point of their talk was. And she loved her job so much, she just wanted to stay there. And Stephen Breyer feels much the same way. And he sort of operated in Ruth Bader Ginsburg's more senior shadow for years. And he's finally now the most senior Democratic appointee. So whenever they're in the minority, as the three Democratic appointees often are, he gets to decide who writes the opinion. And he gets first dibs. And so he's finally in that, for this term, for the first time in that position. And he doesn't, and you know, you can see why he doesn't want to give that up. That said, he's also someone who worked as a staffer for Ted Kennedy on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He has seen what Mitch McConnell has done to politicize the judicial confirmation process to the extent of giving Trump three instead of just one Supreme Court seats to fill. You would think that he would sort of step aside and let Biden name he's in his 80s, step aside and let Biden name his younger replacement. But, you know, this is a club of nine. As much as they may disagree on things, they also are very protective. You know, instead of doing what I just described that I think he should do and what a lot of other people think he should do, he has written a book in which he virtually denies that there is any sort of political bent to the Supreme Court, which all you have to do is read some of the opinions of Sam Alito and the things they do, and the fact that Amy Coney Barrett, despite her, I think, showing she's not as far right as maybe people thought, she nonetheless gives a speech at the Mitch McConnell Center with Mitch McConnell at her side to insist that the court isn't very partisan, which, you know, was like, clearly this Supreme Court justice does not have a press advisor at her side, because it was a really stupid thing to do. It only made the point.
Since you've mentioned Mitch McConnell now
several times,
it's interesting that your book ends by throwing the spotlight on McConnell, and you seem to give him, you know, the award for the most consequential and perhaps malignant figure in American politics of the past several decades.
Yeah, and that's very perceptive of you to bring that up. Because I thought about that. I thought, you know, this book is essentially about Kavanaugh and where Kavanaugh and, you know, what he reflects about the party at large and the party at large. And then I'm ending with this other individual. But I thought it was appropriate. And I do think he's consequential. You can have, you know, I can't take anything away from Mitch McConnell's effectiveness. God knows. But I'm not one of these journalists who thinks that effectiveness is the be-all and end-all. I think there has to be what is the ends that justifies these means? And he would tell you, you know, it's a more conservative government. I think he has undermined the institution of the Senate and the institution of the Supreme Court, two of our branches of government, not bad. And I think that's has consequences. And I can actually say, you know, I I was in covering Congress the year he arrived in January of 1985 when he was elected to the Senate from Kentucky. And I was struck from his very first term that this was a guy who, like Gingrich, for instance, didn't want to be a legislator. He wasn't interested in legislating. He was interested in blocking legislation and, you know, and working to expand things that would help the party, things like expanded campaign finance, things within the Senate. He clearly wanted to get on the leadership ladder. So where he differed from Gingrich is McConnell's was very much an inside game, working the inside the Senate to move up, where Gingrich wanted to be this sort of outside figure running the House, but being this, you know, leader of a conservative movement. And so McConnell obviously has been the most long-lived and more effective than Gingrich ever was. And I just think he's had a huge impact and not a good one. And I have to add, when I think of McConnell is, you know, he is the ultimate, what John McCain used to say, party over country. And I could but won't tick off examples aside from the what we've talked about in terms of his bending all norms and rules to get both Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett on the court, despite any clear hypocrisy that he evidences in doing so. But there's just been so many things over the years as I watched him that I just have to wonder. And now ultimately he's said some of the right things about Donald Trump and his attempted coup, and the extent to which Donald Trump has weakened democracy. But he's then turned around and said he would, quote unquote, absolutely support him as the nominee of the party in 2024 and in every other way enabled Donald Trump. So I think he will continue on far, and whatever happens to Trumpism, Mitch McConnell will remain. And so he is, I think, an overlooked. He gets a lot of attention, but I still think people overlook just how consequential he has been.
Well, Jackie, congratulations again on your book, Dissent, The Radicalization of the Republican Party and Its Capture of the Court. And thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to the Vital Center podcast. Please subscribe and rate us on your preferred podcasting platform. And if you have any questions, comments, or other responses, please include them along with your rating or send us an email at contact@niskanencenter.org. Thanks as always to our technical director, Christy Eshelman, our sound engineer, Ray Ingenieri, and the Niskanen Center in Washington, D.C.